Steve is a world-leading thinker on interdisciplinarity and a friendly critic of interdisciplinarity. So I thought it was a nice way to end the half of the term where we've been looking at the disciplines and interdisciplinarity as an object of study. I thought it would be nice to ask Steve to round off the half term to talk about the future of the discipline. So thank you, Steve.
Thank you. Okay, well, first of all, I want to thank Carl once again for inviting me to this. I'm actually more a critic of the disciplines than I am of interdisciplinarity, to be perfectly honest, okay? But what I want to do in this talk is to say something about how we got to the, because the way universities are organized, right? We can understand universities as a place where people spend a sustained period of time trying to find out the sort of knowledge that's worth having, you know, and studying all sorts of things and all the rest of it. That general kind of notion of the university is pretty well acceptable, and it's something that people, for all kinds of reasons, believe it's important to have. But then there's this additional question, and this is the question I want to begin by addressing, is why do we divide the university into disciplines, right? I mean, because there is a sense in which you might say, because I think one of the original conceptions, if you go back to the ancient Greeks, that the reason why you actually want people to have some kind of advanced training and to, as it were, learn to know more than just what they can get from experience, right? Because as you go through life, you obviously learn stuff and you get knowledge that way. But the point that we want to actually find out about other things that we do not directly experience and may never directly experience, but nevertheless we should think of as part of not only what we know, but perhaps even part of the constitution of the kind of person we think we are. Okay, that kind of idea, right? We see that very much already there in the Western tradition with the ancient Greeks and so forth. And throughout that entire tradition, the idea was that what this kind of advanced training would do, what eventually would be called the university, what was Plato already called the academy, right? This idea of the academy goes back to Plato, was to actually enhance the entire person. So if you look at Plato's academy, for example, right, the kinds of things that you would be studying there would be disciplines in a very kind of strict sense, you might say, in the sense that they require that you master certain kinds of techniques and methods. Right, we use the word discipline in that kind of way, right? When we're not talking about academic subjects, we talk about discipline in the sense of a certain kind of training routine, right? A discipline in that sense. And so, you know, if we're talking about music or we're talking about learning how to speak or learning how to count, mathematics, right? If we're talking about those kinds of fields as being constitutive of what this kind of academic training is, what we're talking mostly about are, you might say, skills, techniques, ways of refining the person, right? So if I teach you how to speak, right, you end up speaking better. I teach you how to count. I teach you how to think about numbers systematically. That's mathematics, right? You come up being much more refined in that sense, much more sophisticated in that sense. You're able to respond in a much more elaborate and detailed way toward whatever happens in the world. Right? A discipline in that respect provides, you might say, a kind of finishing school for the human being. Right? That's the kind of idea. So you come into the school and you're someone who has a lot of potential and you have a lot of, you know, ideas maybe and so forth. But what the school does is to craft them, to kind of hone them. Right? Very much like an artist would. Right? And a good teacher is very much like a good artist in this respect. This is kind of what the original idea of a discipline was about. And when you move into the Middle Ages, so the Middle Ages, we're talking about a period that is basically about, well, what should we say, 1,500 years after Plato, we start to get the beginnings of what we call the university in the West. Places like Oxford and Cambridge and Paris and Bologna, and there are all these places, you know, many of which are still around, interestingly enough, after 800 years, let's say. And the original kind of curriculum in these kinds of places were also disciplines in this respect. They were called arts, liberal arts. Okay? right? And so we're talking, when we think about art, and especially if you understand art in the kind of broad sense of artisanship, right? We're talking about crafting, we're talking about shaping materials into some kind of, you know, what should we say, desirable form. Okay, that's kind of what we're doing whenever we're talking about art, and education is an art in that sense. And the liberal arts are arts that are designed to enable you to function as a free person, because that's what the word liberal is about, okay? The word liberal comes from the Latin to free, right? And this is the kind of skills that you have, which you're able to demonstrate, which will enable other people to recognize you as a free person, as someone who can stand on their own two feet, who can express themselves, who does not need to depend on the authority of others. But you need skills to be that person. And this is what the liberal arts provide. Okay? And so when you go to the Middle Ages and you look at the kinds of things that they were teaching back then in the 13th century, 14th century, whatever, you will find they are teaching grammar. They are teaching logic. They are teaching rhetoric. They are teaching mathematics. They are teaching astronomy as a way of being able to see. How to see things far away. How to adjust your vision. How to have a keen sense of vision. You would be taught music and poetry. You'd be taught those kinds of things that in all sorts of ways craft you and refine you and enable you to function as a free person who is able to make judgments for themselves and to be able to express themselves publicly. That was what the original universities were about. Okay? And what you would get at the end of your time would be a master of arts. And I think the phrase kind of sums it up, okay? And that is what the university was originally about. And I think, to my mind, that is what the university should remain. But then a lot of stuff happened in the middle, okay, to get to where we are now. And one of the things that happened was that the notion of discipline changed, okay? And here, I think you have to look at what kind of a social function the universities played during the Middle Ages. Because they weren't just about refining people, you know, in this way that I've been describing some, you know, so far, with regard to being, you know, these free, liberated, emancipated people with all of these kinds of skills that enable them to stand on their own two feet. It wasn't just that. That was kind of the preserve pretty much, you know, for wealthy people who could pay, or sometimes, you know, other poor people who come through in very curious channels, sometimes are being orphaned. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that poor people came in, not very systematically, but the point is that could happen too. But the other thing the university was doing wasn't just training individuals, you know, to sort of be able to rule countries and govern whatever lands they had, which is pretty much what you did if you were a free person back in those days. But one of the things that it would do, it would also credential you. Okay? So in other words, there was this other degree that you could get at universities. And it was called a doctorate. And back then, right, the doctorates were in the subjects that we would call professional subjects today. So medicine, law, theology, right, where you're thinking about administering to the soul, right? Law administers to the nation, right, to the society, right? Medicine administers to the body. Theology administers to the soul. These were professions, right? And there were doctorates to be gained in this. And what would be the consequence of gaining this kind of a degree? You would then be licensed to administer, basically. Right, it would be this is the whole point of having it would be kind of an administrative function. You would be entrusted. People would be able to trust you, right? You know, so you go to a doctor, right? The doctor is empowered. You can trust the doctor. The doctor is credentialed. The doctor knows how to deal with your body better than you do. The lawyer knows how to deal with your affairs better than you do. The theologian knows how to deal with your soul better than you do. This is it's an administrative function. It is doing something for your benefit, on your behalf, right, with your consent, but on the assumption that you couldn't do it yourself. Okay? And that was what the original professional degrees were about, and that's how they remain today. And increasingly, university degrees have functioned in this capacity, you might say, okay? And that is a capacity of credentials. And so if you ask people, why do you go to university in the first place? And then you ask the second question, why do you go to this university rather than that university? You will see, in most cases, at least part of the answer, if not the entire answer, has to do with credentials. I want to gain credentials. Okay? I want to get into a position where I am able to administer something. Right? This is the primary reason. I'm not going to a university because somehow I want to empower myself in some generic way as a human being, as a citizen in a free society. No, that's not the main reason why I go to university. I go to university because I want to administer something in society. I want a piece of the action. And the only way I can get the ticket is through a credential. Okay? And so this is a big change, right? This is a big change. And the point is that if you go to the early history of the university in the Middle Ages, the distinction is there, right? The distinction is there between the master of the arts and the doctors. And what happens is, over the course of history, for various reasons, at various times and places, right, the doctorate function, the credentialing function, ends up dominating. Okay? And there are interesting stories to be told about this. But what I want to do at this point is to actually go back and look at how the term discipline changes to accommodate this transformation. Okay? So what does discipline mean in the modern era? I mean, I already told you what it means when we're talking about the Middle Ages. We're talking about logic, rhetoric, grammar, you know, music, poetry, whatever, astronomy, right? We're talking about skills, basically. But when you get into the modern era, you start to get a different kind of conception of discipline. And it's a conception of discipline which, in a way, sort of turns everything into turf. Right? The whole idea of the administrative function of credentials is the idea that, you know, if you study this and you get the doctorate, then you have command over a field. Right? This word field, it's a word, it's a metaphor, right? So field, literally, we're talking about land, right? We're talking about land, field, right? But when we talk about your command over a field from an intellectual standpoint, right, we're talking about that you've mastered a discipline in the sense of a subject matter, right? A subject matter of a particular field, right? Physics, chemistry, biology, history, philosophy, whatever, right? And these things are conceptualized as fields. So in other words, the whole administrative mentality that originated in medicine, law, and theology gets imported to basically talk about all of knowledge. And this begins to happen in the 19th century. Okay? And the modern university, starting in the second half of the 19th century especially, becomes the period where people start seriously to think about knowledge as basically, in geographic, cartographic terms, right? That there is, you know, so you do maps of knowledge and you carve them up into disciplines. And that's what the discipline is basically your ability to master one of the fields that have been carved up on this map. Right? And we police this as academics. We police this. And the way we police this is by making appeal to the idea of expertise. Right? Expertise. So, you know, if a certain topic comes up, you know, a topic about, well, you know, how are we going to solve problems of poverty or welfare or whatever we're talking about, right? Then the question comes up, well, who should we call? Who should we consult? Who should we talk to? Who will give us some sound advice on what to do? We need experts. And who are these experts? These experts are the products of this kind of disciplinary training whereby people become masters of a field. And the field is well defined. Right? There are boundaries around the field. Nobody is an expert in everything. When we talk about experts, one of the assumptions of that term is that it is bounded. Right? And when we talk about people having more than one expertise, this is usually seen as amazing. Because it means, oh, they master two fields. Right? So the idea here is expertise is contained, it's bounded. And it's the product of a lot of intensive training in a very particular area. Okay? This is the way it's understood. The word expertise, in the way we talk about it today in English, actually originates in the late 19th century. It's not a term that really gets used very much before then. It comes from the French originally, and where the word expert gets used to describe the appearance of academics in court proceedings. What we call expert witnesses, that's the original, where you start to really see a widespread use of the word expert and expertise. It comes from this practice, which starts to get instituted in the late 19th century, right? And so you bring in experts, like handwriting experts in criminal cases, right? You see, is this the writing of the person who did this, right? This sort of thing. And these people, expert is a contraction of experienced. And what kind of experience we're talking about? Well, of course, of seeing similar cases in the past, but also having trained in such a way to be able to see those cases in the right way. Right? Because you can imagine an amateur, for example, looking at handwriting, right? And having seen lots of handwriting and making, quote, educated guesses about what you can say about the emotional state of the person who's handwriting. Right? Anyone could do that. It could even be kind of a party game to do that. Well, who is an expert in doing this? It's not just someone who's looked at a lot of different handwritings, but someone who's been trained to look at it in the right way. That's where the expertise comes from, right? So it's experienced, where experienced is understood as not simply your encounter with empirical phenomena, not just your experience in that raw sense, but it's trained experience, right? And that's where the idea originally comes in, and then it starts to basically populate everywhere. Everything becomes an expertise in this sense. Okay? And a lot of our public debates that we see today, right, about experts, bringing experts in, what experts say, how you make of what experts say, often turns on this kind of point. Because very often the kinds of things that experts are talking about and what they say are very often about things that ordinary people have had a lot of experience of. Maybe even more experience in some sort of direct encounter way than the experts have. Yet the experts should be trusted. And so everything rides on the training. Right? Everything rides on the training. And so then there's a question about where does this training come from? What is it based on? Okay? And this is where it gets a little tricky, right? I mean, I'm originally trained as a philosopher of science, and, you know, we have this term in philosophy, epistemology, about the theory of knowledge. How do you get your knowledge? Carl was saying, I founded this field called social epistemology. Well, what we're talking about right now is social epistemology. Okay, this is what we're talking about here. How do these experts get their knowledge? Why, in a way that we should trust their experience over the experience of other people who seem to have been encountering the same things as the experts, if not more so. Okay? And this is the question. And this is where you have to look at how, in fact, disciplines are constituted today. How are these academic fields constituted? Right? That is to say, how is the knowledge being produced that then is used to teach these people who go on to be experts? And is this appropriate? Is this right? I mean, does this make sense, this kind of story? And I'm going to tell you the story now. But the point is, this is what you should keep in the back of your mind, okay? That basically what we have, when we talk about you know, that we live in a society where you need a credential to get by, and everybody's got to be an expert in something, then the first question you need to ask is, where are they getting this expertise from? How is this knowledge being produced and transmitted through the university? Because the university is basically the place where all this stuff is being validated and certified. Okay, so this is the question. So we start and we think about how disciplines are organized. Well, the thing that's very interesting, of course, is that disciplines come with histories, right? I mean, so when we talk about physics, let's say, and I mentioned physics, not only because it tends to be very much a gold standard discipline, you might say, but also because it's a history, it's a discipline, you might say, that wears its history very lightly on its sleeve. Okay, in the sense that you could perhaps study quite a lot of physics without ever knowing anything about the history of physics. Yet the history of physics wasn't just cooked up because somebody looked at the sky and came up with Newton's laws, okay? It wasn't that straightforward. And this is not a trivial point, because of course, I think there are other fields, if you look at, let's say, the way the humanities have developed and the way the social sciences have developed, right? I think it's pretty easy, if you're sort of a semi-critical person, to look at these fields and you say, well, the fact that they emphasize certain kinds of issues and certain kinds of approaches to the issues over others, this is probably for historical reasons. In other words, you can imagine quite alternative ways of going about studying the same thing than the ways that are dominant at the moment. I think that's, and in fact, a lot of the disputes, the culture wars and canon wars and all these things that go on in universities where people are sort of arguing about what should be the foundations of the disciplines and the humanities and social sciences, it's about that, right? Where there's a sense in which these disciplines are seen as, in a sense, where, you know, they're too much determined by their histories. And so what counts as expertise in, let's say, literature, or what counts as expertise in history or philosophy or fields like that, right, are in a sense overdetermined by the way those disciplines came to be the way they are. Right? So if you understood the history of the discipline, you'll understand what the discipline's doing now. And maybe that's a little too convenient. Right? That's a little too convenient, especially if those disciplines are meant to be carrying some kind of authority. Okay? So if you study philosophy, you get a PhD in philosophy, you're teaching philosophy, and all you know is Western philosophy. And not only that, all you know is Western philosophy published in the English-speaking world. You might say a lot of the potential subject matter is being left out, yet you're an expert. Okay, it's this kind of problem that we're talking about here. And this problem is not limited to the humanities and social sciences, but it's also there in the natural sciences. It's just the natural sciences are really good in covering up their tracks. Okay, and a lot has to do with mathematics. Because mathematics is a wonderful thing, but it actually obscures very often, unless you know the history of mathematics, right? It obscures the historical roots, right? Because one of the ways in which you can see a lot of the historical roots in disciplines is by looking at the language they use to describe things and to characterize things. And you wonder, why do they call this that, right? Because as a student, when you're mastering a discipline, one of the first things that you have to do, because you go into a discipline because you're interested in the subject matter, but the first thing you're faced with is the fact that you've got all this technical jargon that you have to master. So in a sense, part of what's going on with that technical jargon is actually getting you to recode stuff that in some sense you sort of already know, you've already encountered. In fact, that's what attracted you to the field in the first place. But now you've got to put it in a language that makes sense to the experts. This is what, right? This is like the first year you got to work through this. It's like learning a new language. Now you see, when you're learning that new language, that's when you can start looking at the historical traces. Why do they call this that? Why don't they call it something else? Why is there this very complicated word for talking about this thing? Well, when you get to the bottom of all those questions, you will see it has everything to do with the specific ways in which the disciplines develop. Okay? In economics, we have this term, path dependency. Okay? Path dependency. In other words, the way things turn out is very much determined by how they begin. Why? Because if the beginning is a strong anchor point, In other words, people gravitate around it, so the discipline begins at this point and everybody kind of moves in its direction, then what happens is that the possibilities, the alternatives that could be used to define the discipline disappear over time. And so by the time you get to the second or third or fourth generation of people practicing the discipline, nobody even knows that there were alternative ways of doing things. Because those people don't exist anymore and they're not written about in the textbooks. Okay, that's path dependency. I mean, this term in economics, by the way, for those of you curious, is primarily used to talk about what's called technological lock-in, right? So why do PCs look exactly the way they do rather than some other kind of way? Well, there was technological lock-in, right, in one kind of way of looking at things. You can blame Bill Gates or whatever for it, right? And then everybody else disappears. The same thing happens in academic disciplines as well, okay? So there's a point in which the expertise of academic fields are very much constrained by their histories, by very particular ways in which they get into the subject matter. And this is true across the board, okay? Now, perhaps the most important theorist of science of the second half of the 20th century, Thomas Kuhn, loved this. He valorized this. Okay? This is what he's on about. If you've ever heard of Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, how many of you have heard of this book, if anyone? As the years go by, it disappears, but a few of you have. Okay, good. All right. Okay, well then you might know that he's got this word, paradigm. This is what I'm talking about. Right? The paradigm is this path-dependent approach to a discipline. Right? Once you get a kind of signature success in the field, one person's able to do a lot in the field with, let's say, a limited set of theoretical assumptions, with a certain circumscribed range of methods, comes up with some striking solutions, then everybody goes for that. That becomes an attractor. And so all the other alternative ways in which you could be dealing with the same problems in the field start to get eliminated. And moreover, once the paradigm gets institutionalized in terms of courses, degree programs, and in other words, as soon as the university gets in on the act, right, then this really happens, right? In other words, whole alternative traditions can just disappear. And then the only way in which you can show, let's say, that you understand anything about the economy is by getting an economics degree where you will be learning economics in a very specific kind of way. Okay, that's one consequence. And this applies to every field. Because if you think about it, every discipline in the sense of field of knowledge actually covers a lot more in principle than is actually actively researched by the people who are considered experts in the field. It is not that every aspect of a disciplinary field is equally explored by all the experts. There's a lot more attention paid to certain things than to other things. And other areas just go completely neglected. This is also about the path dependency, it's about the paradigm. And you see, one of the things that then starts to surround this from an institutional sociological standpoint is the reward structure of academia. In other words, how do you get ahead in this business? Suppose I do get credentials and I'm an expert. How do I get ahead? Well, what you have to do, and to a large extent, unless you're something of a risk taker, is you've got to follow the pack. In other words, you have to, the safest way to make a strong career as an academic expert is to actually make a striking discovery in a field that a lot of people are already working in. And people do that. And some of them get Nobel Prizes even. Okay? But what it is very difficult to do in this kind of way of understanding how knowledge develops is to actually be very successful by doing something totally different, by going outside the mainstream. And I think one of the ways you could see this, I mean, part of it is a kind of a publicity problem. Okay? Because even though academics in their fields are encouraged, and they do, publish enormous amounts of stuff, in these peer-reviewed journals you're always hearing about, right? And perhaps too much stuff, frankly. There is a striking phenomenon, and it is a version of what's called the 80-20 rule, which is also called sometimes Pareto's law, for those of you in economics again. And this is the way Pareto put it originally was that 80% of the effects are the product of 20% of the possible causes. Okay? And what we want to say here in the context that I'm talking about is that 80% of, let's say, the citations, and the that is to say, the academics who are recognized by other academics in their own writing, right? So when you read an academic journal article, right, at the end of the academic journal article, there are all these citations, all these references to other academics, basically, and they're the ones who are given credit in some way for what has been said in the article itself. They back the article, aspects of the argument of the article, okay? Well, those, if you look at those people, the people who are in those reference lists, okay, those are, you know, roughly speaking, they constitute altogether only about 20% of all the people who actually publish. So in other words, if you publish an article, okay, there is a very strong chance, right, 80% chance perhaps, that it will not be cited, or it'll be cited only once or twice, whereas there will be very few people on the other end who will be cited thousands of times. Okay? And, you know, there is a branch of scientometrics measuring the shape of scientific knowledge. And it's about looking at the tendencies in this, right? So we've got these academic disciplines where people are being encouraged to publish their research. In fact, they need to publish their research in order to keep their jobs going. And this provides then, the basic knowledge base for expertise as we understand it in society at large. At the end of the day, it's always the academic knowledge base that people go back to, okay? But then you look at the characteristics of the academic knowledge base, which is increasing by leaps and bounds in terms of sheer quantity all the time, and you continue to see this phenomenon, right, where 80% of the citations go to 20% of the people, and there are a lot of people who just never get cited at all. Okay? Now, I'm talking here about articles that in all cases, whether they're cited or not, have been peer-reviewed. That's an important point. Because you just can't start by saying, oh, those articles that aren't cited are rubbish. Well, journal editors thought they were worth publishing. They passed through the competency tests and so forth. That's not the answer. It's not about they're rubbish. Because these are, we're not just talking about, this is not the internet we're talking about here. I mean, if we were talking about people publishing on the internet and you got the same result, namely that, you know, 80% of the hits on the internet go to only 20% of the sites, of the websites, right? You could understand that as being a kind of quality control check. I think that would be a natural way of understanding it. It's the so-called wisdom of crowds. But when you're talking about this phenomenon happening within academia, there's a different thing going on here, okay? Because these are actually articles that have passed through the review process. In other words, academics have already deemed these things good articles. Otherwise, they wouldn't be published. And yet, we still see the same phenomenon. Okay? Now, what I would submit to you is that the reason why we see this is part of the way in which the disciplinary structure of academic life actually channels people's attention so that people are, in fact, encouraged to just pay attention to the people who everybody else is paying attention to. Right? These are the people who define the so-called cutting-edge problems, right, that are on the frontiers of knowledge. And the interesting thing about this is that there is actually a kind of interesting interdisciplinary spread on this phenomenon I'm talking about. So, for example, what is 80-20 in a general way, as you get to the sort of harder reaches of the natural sciences, especially those where there's some Nobel Prize potential going on, right, the ratio may be 90-10, right, where there's a sense in which very few things are focused on. everybody's focused on the same narrow things. Whereas if you go to the other end and you're looking at the humanities, then you get something that is much more evenly distributed. Because the humanities and even the social sciences, certainly outside of economics, don't have such clear cutting edge of research, right? There are lots of different things going on simultaneously, and no particular one is necessarily dominant. Okay? And remember, what Kuhn was saying about paradigms is that you only have a paradigm in science when everybody pretty much agrees on the rules of the game, understands what it is they should be doing, and so in some sense are working very much in unison. And so from Kuhn's standpoint, the more and more that you get these kinds of extreme ratios, right, where most of the effort is being focused on a very narrow range of all the stuff that's going on out there, the closer you actually get to science. Okay, so expertise, in a way, progresses through being narrowed, right, by being more focused. Now, the punchline of this, and I'll stop in a couple of minutes, is, of course, this can't go on forever. And the end of Kuhn's story, as you know, because his book is so-called Structure of Scientific Revolutions, when does the revolution happen, you might ask? Okay, well, the revolution happens because when the expertises get so narrow and so focused, then it becomes clearer and clearer that the limited terms in which the researchers are operating is insufficient to solve even their own problems. This is the point. And this is where you get to a crisis in the paradigm. Right? When expertise starts to implode, where people who have been trained to claim, and people have been led to believe, that they can solve this problem, and they've got these very specific ways of doing it, and it doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen again and again and again. Then you get the crisis. Crisis in the paradigm and the crisis in expertise. And it's at that point that you then have the basis for a revolution. And the revolution then, for a short period of time, opens up the possibility space. In other words, you start to see people are willing to discuss quite openly alternative assumptions, alternative principles on which this field of knowledge could be based. It happens for a short period of time, and then it closes again, and you get the next paradigm. And this is what Kuhn believes. It's a cycle, basically. Now, the question, of course, that I think is before us, and this is where I will end, is that the kind of picture that Kuhn is describing, that I think from an empirical standpoint should be very recognizable with regard to the way in which universities operate by default today, is one where the possibility for substantial change can only come from the inside, right? It's about discipline self-destructing and reconstituting themselves. That's what the narrative is about in Kuhn. It's not about external pressure. It's not about society. It's not about the economy. It's not about, you know, ordinary people or anything like that, somehow pressuring the academic establishment to change the way it produces knowledge. Rather, it is something that happens internally. By the scientific community, to the scientific community, for the scientific community. And you see, when we start to, you know, think about the way of the role of the university in the society today, and it's a very contested space, I think everybody will admit, in terms of justifying tuition fees or whatever you want to talk about, this kind of issue then becomes very important. Because what I've described to you is pretty much how academic knowledge production has become very discipline-driven in the modern period, largely as a result of people trusting the value of expertise, which is to say, largely trusting academics to be able to determine for themselves how knowledge should be produced. Okay? And I will stop here and take some questions. Is this my phone ringing? Oh, never mind. We'll take questions. Take questions.
Are there any questions?
Yes. Oh, sure. Okay. Well, look. So Kuhn's main example is physics, okay? And it has to do with the way Newtonian mechanics fell apart. So Newton's theory, right, presupposes certain kinds of ideas of absolute space and time and causation, and it's a theory of physics that actually works pretty well for engineering, even as we understand it today. And it was the dominant theory in physics for 200 years, from the late 18th century to the late 19th century. Okay, well, late 17th century to the late 19th century. And then what happens is that there were certain phenomena that Newton could never explain. But neither could his successors over those 200 years. And one of them is the movement of light, for example. Is it a wave? Is it a particle? This seemed to defy the way Newton thought about things. There was also problems about what the speed of light was exactly when light was moving very fast or whatever. And this is what led to the revolution. After two centuries of people trying to kind of do experiments within the narrow constraints of Newtonianism to be able to solve these problems, they just realized they couldn't do it. The paradigm was spent. And so you got this kind of very big kind of reconstitution of physics with Einstein's relativity theory and with the quantum mechanics in the early 20th century. And physics is still living with that kind of situation. But that's the main example, in a sense, because physics was a great example of a discipline where all the researchers were very much focused on doing things the same way and had actually achieved quite a lot over those two centuries. So it wasn't that physics was like wasting its time, okay? I mean, this is the period of the Industrial Revolution. You think about how the modern age came into being. But at the end of the day, the assumptions that the field was based on were too narrow to deal with these kinds of phenomena. And that led to the revolution. So that would be the example of a field that within itself basically caused the revolution. Does that make sense to you? Okay. See, in a sense, physics is, you might say, is kind of the toughest case for this kind of thing. Yeah?
Where do you see the crisis now? Because you've got two disciplines where you see this is going to really happen in the next, I don't know, 5-10 years.
Well, I do think, well, in terms of this story, there are a lot of disciplines that are sort of open. I mean, I think the general problem here is, there's a general problem. The general problem is that insofar as disciplines are promising expertise in increasingly narrow conceptions of their discipline, they're not necessarily going to be providing students with credentials that'll be useful for actually getting the sorts of jobs students are likely to get. Right? So there's a sense in which the whole dynamic of this story I'm telling you is to make people much more specialized and much more narrow in particular areas, much more so than what the name of the discipline would indicate. And so as a result, when you get your credential, let's say in physics or economics or whatever, you actually come out of there knowing a lot less than I think perhaps your employer would expect of you. Okay? And I think already employers are backing away from credentials as any kind of signaling device with regard to the competence of people. You know, so we're in a period now where I actually think that the university you come from matters more than actually the discipline you come from. That used to only happen in the case of Oxford and Cambridge, but I think that's happening across the board now, largely because I think the value of particular disciplines as providing a signal in terms of competence is not particularly useful to employers anymore. That would be my view. And one of the ways you can see this is look at the employment tracks of students who get degrees in different subjects. Most of them are going into fields quite unexpected or kind of strangely related to the fields where they actually got their degrees in. That should tell you something about the value of credentials. At most, it opens a door. It isn't some kind of straightforward path to a particular career, because the way the world is organized does not correspond to the way in which disciplines, you know, construct the academy. There is a kind of mismatch there. Other issues? Come on, you must have some questions. You, sir?
But isn't that more of a crisis of credentials rather than a crisis within the disciplines?
Well,
wouldn't we need to want to rethink?
Well, how do people get credentials? This is the point, right? The way you become an economist is by getting a degree in economics. So you look at what's being taught in the economics department. There's a very This is the whole point, right? People treat the degrees that you get, and certainly students tend to do this, as somehow credentialing devices in the sense that it should open up the door to certain kinds of jobs. And universities promote degree programs this way. And I'm telling you it's false. That's my point. Boy, this is false advertising across the board.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm saying that if there's a change in what employers expect from credentials, then sure, that's not a crisis within...
It is because, well, look, okay, let me... Okay. You've just walked right into it. No. Look, the point is they're not going to use credentials anymore, right? Accounting firms already use their own in-house examinations, right? They don't care what university or what degree you got, as long as you can pass exams, very often very systematic exams, which involve interviews as well, so they're not trivial things, basically to see whether you are capable of doing the kind of job they expect people in that firm to be able to do. Okay, so they're bypassing credentials altogether, and I think this is just a thin edge of the wedge. Okay, I think as employers wise up, and realize they're spending a lot of time training all of these blue chip people from all these wonderful universities how to do basic stuff, at least from the standpoint of the employer, right? They're not going to turn to these people anymore. Okay, and I think students after a while will wise up and rethink why they want to go to university. And by the way, the punchline of this for me is that they'll start thinking in the more fundamental terms that I began my talk with, right? That it'll be about, you know, you as a person. What kind of person do you want to be, right? Above and beyond whatever job you end up getting. Because whatever job you end up getting is going to be determined pretty much by the dynamic forces of capitalism, which are largely beyond the control of either you or this university, okay? And so the point is, nevertheless, you have to be able to live a satisfactory life in the meanwhile. And this is where the liberal arts actually matters a lot. Yes?
But just as in the Middle Ages with the Master of Arts versus Doctorate, the Master of Arts is more for the elite and the wealthy. Do you think if we move towards, move away from the credentials and towards the Master of Arts and this idea of an liberated person, could that be also for the wealthy in this kind?
Well, look, here's the thing. I mean, I didn't mention the great man, but if you look up Humboldt, Wilhelm von Humboldt, okay? He is the father of the modern university in the early 19th century. His idea was to extend what was originally a very elite liberal arts curriculum as a way of nation building project for Germany, right? In other words, if you've got all of the academically talented people, even from the poor backgrounds, and you brought them in, and you gave them this kind of treatment that you got in this liberal arts program, then you would actually really, as we would say now, really build up the human capital of your society. And so he wasn't talking about training people for jobs. This is the point, right? He was talking about nation building, but it wasn't in the context of training for jobs. It was training for life. And there the liberal arts was the centerpiece. And that was to bring in, and so he instituted lots of examinations to bring in poor people who would otherwise never go to university because they can't afford it, to bring them into that kind of curriculum, to the liberal arts curriculum. And I think that's where we should be heading. We should be kind of moving more in that direction. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Do you think that these crises will be sort of trapped within the disciplines, or could there be a wider crisis?
Well, I think this goes to the original question that he was raising, that Carl was raising. I think there's going to be the crises are going to be multiple. They're going to be independent, but they're going to form maybe a perfect storm around the university, especially as employers, both students who are paying a lot of money to go to university and employers who feel they're not getting enough out of the people they're employing, are going to basically challenge the idea that the university is worth whether credentials are the sort of thing that a university can reliably provide. So I think it's going to, the notion of credential as a place where the discipline tries to present itself as something practical for the rest of the world, I think that's where the crisis is going to happen. It's in that kind of interface idea. And that's why, you know, when Michael Gove said, you know, we've had enough with experts, remember that? He said that during the Brexit campaign, right? That's a harbinger. That's a harbinger. What he said is not a stray thing. That is something that is going to continue, and it's going to lead to this questioning of the value of credentials altogether. Yes?
But what's the alternative to this
It depends. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that there is a we need to reconstruct things, but it isn't an either or proposition. This would be the point. And what you're calling depth and narrowing, right, is at an enormous cost. Okay? And actually a lot of, you know, and here we might think about our relationship to information technology in a more creative way. Because very often the kind of depth that academic disciplines pursue, especially in the natural sciences, are of the sort that actually computers could do better. Okay? And I do think that we might want to think along those lines, right? So I have nothing against greater accuracy, greater reliability, greater precision, all that kind of stuff. I have nothing against it. But there's a sense in which what is it that human beings, as it were, ought to be doing themselves, and what is it that perhaps to a certain extent we could have some of our very, you know, increasingly impressive information technology be doing on our behalf, right? So there's that. But my bottom line is to go back to her point, right, is that we would have a more liberal arts orientation to how people pursue knowledge. So that if they are, let's say they do major in academic subjects, so I don't want to say we obliterate them tomorrow, but the point is the requirements for getting a degree in, let's say, economics or physics would not be so focused on the department. It would actually require a lot more looking outside of the department. In fact, I would be comfortable with only having 50%. If you get an economics degree, that only 50% of your courses are in economics. And then there are the other things, right? We could start with that, for example. We could start with that as a kind of halfway point between the two extremes you're talking about.
Stop you,
oh, sorry.
Can we thank Steve very much for today, then?
Thank you. Okay, well, let me...
Thank you.